Newly awakened people all over the world pose a problem for what's known as Western interests, which is imperialism, colonialism, racism, and all these other negative isms or vulturistic isms.
As we say in California, stay woke, because we must stay vigilant and we must insist that our freedom of speech is preserved, our First Amendment rights. We must understand that young people, all people, need access to a free internet.
There's this big fear of developing fascism in this country. And I think it's creating a lot of confusion about what fascism is. A lot of people think that fascism perhaps might be something different than capitalism. I think it would be important for us in this moment to study fascism and study its relationship to capitalism. If there is one, I think there is.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarim, and on today's show, The F Word, our monthly discussion on fascism. This month's guest is Jerome Scott, veteran activist, labor organizer, and a founding member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which was active in the auto plants of Detroit in the 1960s to 70s. This is the birthday of human rights giant and Muslim minister Malcolm X. Had he not been taken away from us and lived, he would be 92 years old today. We'll be playing more excerpts of his speeches that are included in that Voices That Changed the World mega drive from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Also, one of the important behind-the-scenes things that happened this week that is not being covered by the corporate media is the FCC actually making moves to gut net neutrality, to gut rules that keep the internet open, free, and equally accessible to everyone. There was a big FCC meeting yesterday to start this nefarious process, and an even bigger response outside by a rally of demonstrators saying, "Hands off my internet." So here are headlines today. Protesters gathered outside the Department of Justice in Northwest D.C. this week to denounce the new directive by Attorney General Jeff Sessions that will restart the failed war on drugs by seeking draconian maximum sentences for minor low-level nonviolent drug offenses. Experts have concluded that the decades-long so-called war on drugs only incarcerated more people engaged in these lower levels of the drug trade, exacerbated racial and ethnic disparities in the federal criminal justice system, and fed the private prison industry. Human rights attorney Nkechi Taifa told WPFW Pacifica on Tuesday that a broad coalition is denouncing the rule reversal by Sessions.
The war on drugs is a failed policy, and what Sessions has done, his guidance to prosecutors to charge the most harshest offenses that they can to defendants, that move flies in the face of the growing consensus in America that we cannot incarcerate our way to justice. People in this country, we're tired of spending money on policies that don't work, and that is what's happening. That is what we are protesting. No more drug war.
And in a follow-up story related to mass incarceration, the Movement for Black Lives sent out a statement this week announcing that more than 100 mothers across the country were bailed out of jail in time to spend Mother's Day at home, and that 11,000 people contributed more than $700,000 for this campaign. Organizers and community members in Oakland, Los Angeles, St. Petersburg, Montgomery, Memphis, Durham, Atlanta, Houston, New York, Little Rock, Charlottesville, Charlotte, Birmingham, Baltimore, Philadelphia, St. Louis, and here in the D.C. area welcome mothers home. Now, similar efforts are underway to challenge the money bail system and to assist fathers who have not been convicted of any crime but cannot afford to bail. They can't afford their bail or to buy their freedom, as the organizers say, before Father's Day. And more information is at themovementforblacklives.org. On Thursday, the FCC moved ahead with those plans to gut net neutrality rules that maintain the Internet as a level playing field where all have equal access. Chantel James attended that rally outside the FCC building in Northwest D.C. and filed this report.
When FCC Chairman Pai presided over the meeting where he unveiled the latest in his plan to compromise net neutrality on Thursday, he was met by a crowd of protesters. Free Press, an organization that champions net neutrality and freedom on the Internet, had organized speakers such as Congresswoman Barbara Lee to address those gathered downtown.
We must let the FCC commissioners hear us loud and clear that we want to keep the Internet free, fair, and open. Free, fair, and open. And I just have to say, yes, I come from the great East Bay, the 13th Congressional District of California, right next door to Silicon Valley. And many of my constituents are outraged by what is taking place here. We have small entrepreneurs. We have people who rely on the Internet for their livelihoods, who want to engage in freedom of speech. This is just another effort by the Republicans to shut down the free press. And what does that mean, shutting down free speech? And so I just want to thank you all for being here. I wanted you to know that it's important that we, as we say in California, stay woke, because we must stay vigilant, and we must insist that our freedom of speech is preserved, our First Amendment rights. We must understand that young people, all people, need access to a free Internet. So we're not going to let this happen. We're not going to let corporate America take over the free press. And so I just want to thank you again for being here. We're going to fight to make sure that the open Internet, that net neutrality remains, and we're not going to let Steve Bannon and Donald Trump and the Republicans on this FCC roll back our access to the free press. So thank you again very much. Thank you all for being here, and stay woke.
In the shadow of the FCC's downtown headquarters, protesters offered voices of resistance against the Trump era's increasing disregard for their freedoms. Joseph Torres, a member of Free Press, explains the concept of net neutrality and tells us why it's important now more than ever.
Today, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission Chairman, Chairman Ajit Pai, is going to start a rulemaking procedure, the beginning of a process to kill net neutrality.
Right.
And net neutrality is a concept that all content online is treated equally, that Comcast and Verizon creates fast lanes and slow lanes for those who can pay more so their sites load faster and can't discriminate or block traffic online. Verizon has said that is no different than a newspaper publisher. You should be able to pick and choose what it publishes online.
Right.
So we're trying to protect free speech online. And so this is the beginning of a process by the Trump administration to kill free speech online, any kind of, and, you know, which is critically important for organizing and for dissenting voices.
So how are you guys measuring your victory today?
Well, today is not a victory. We've been in the process of organizing and the resistance to this. So this is a rally to show up. We had some senators, we had some members of Congress like Barbara Lee here to make the public aware of what's going on. Last time in 2015, when we actually won this fight here at the FCC, when the Obama FCC was going to go the wrong way in neutrality, they ended up doing the right thing. But it was because close to 4 million people commented and told the FCC that we want to support an open internet, net neutrality. With everything going on in this world right now, it's so crazy. Fires are being lit everywhere, right? This is literally healthcare to environment to James Comey. There's so many things grabbing our attention. We're trying to say, hey, this critically important tool, the open internet that allows us, for me as a person of color, is a critical racial justice issue.
Right.
To be able to make sure we fight to maintain the internet as it always existed. What they're trying to do is take away a right from us. The internet has always been an open platform for us to speak freely. What they're trying to do is take away that right and have the ISPs, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon decide winners or losers online.
So are you feeling optimistic about the fight for free speech on the internet with everything that's been going on with Trump?
I do. You know, I feel optimistic. This is an issue where the other side has, like, no support.
Mm-hmm.
The only people who support it are people who Comcast hates.
Right.
Everyday people, you go out there in the so-called real world and you hear what every child is, they don't like their cable companies. They know their cable companies are up to no good. So they're with us once it's just common sense. So all we're trying to do is maintain the internet as it always has functioned. And so I think that's our challenge. Our challenge is to get the public aware, particularly in this environment. And if the public is aware, I think we have a shot.
From the FCC building in Southwest DC, this is Chantal James.
Thank you, Chantel, for that coverage. Organizers of the rally, the organization Free Press, said that people from across the country have already generated more than 1 million comments and signatures opposing the moves being made by FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. In other culture, media, and direct actions, this week, Friends of the Congo marked 20 years after Mobutu Sese Seko, with a retrospective look over the years since the overthrow of the U.S.-backed and maintained dictator of then Zaire, now the Republic of the Congo. Related, the 45th anniversary of the celebration of African Liberation Day will be marked May 27th here in D.C. with a parade and march followed by a program at Union Temple, 1225 W Street in Southeast D.C. More information is at ALDUHURU.org. That's ALDUHURU.org. And the poetry series Sunday Kind of Love at Busboys and Poets 14th and V features on May 21st at 5 p.m. poets Reuben Jackson and Tara Betts. The series is sponsored by Split This Rock, which calls poets to a greater role in public life and fostering a national network of socially engaged poets. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, is this country moving more and more to a consolidated fascism? Stay with us.
they jump from mouth like water rush from pump. The way people they lie, them no they fear them God. The way people they lie, them no they fear them shrine. Them just they lie.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW, Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam, and now we're turning to our monthly segment, The F Word, a discussion of fascism today. Our touchstone remains the definition by 1960s revolutionary George Jackson about fascism being the complete control of the state by monopoly capital when the relationship between the state and the corporation becomes indiscernible. Jerome Scott is my guest today, and he's a veteran labor organizer and founding member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in the auto plants of Detroit in the 1960s and 70s. He's a community organizer, popular educator, and author in the South since the 1970s. He was a founding member and former director of Project South, Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide in Atlanta, and he serves on the National Planning Committee of the U.S. Social Forum. And I actually met him in February of this year when he spoke at Howard University on the topic Race, Class, and Struggle, Then and Now, Lessons from the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Welcome to the show, Jerome. Oh, can I call you Jerome?
Oh, definitely. Okay. And I am happy that you invited me on your program.
Well, in all the inner beltway and media chaos we have here around the presidency of Donald Trump, very little attention is being paid by the media to jobs, labor, and the coziness of corporations to Trump, and the fact that Trump is not able to deliver on improved economy and more jobs, maybe except for police and prison guards. So I want to start with that. You know, what are your views on what is happening now? Because I know in your talk at Howard University, you described the U.S. as moving toward a consolidated fascism.
You know, that is a really big question, what's happening now. And this whole question of moving toward a consolidated fascism. Many people think that we are presently living in a fascist state. And you know, and I believe that many of the prerequisites for fascism have been laid down. And I think that there are a lot of myths, though, about what we mean when we talk about fascism. You know, first of all, I think it's important for us to understand that we live in a class society. And capitalism as a class society is really governed by what historically has been called the ruling class or the corporate class or the political class. It's really all combined into, you know, the class that actually many times behind the scenes run this country. And it is that ruling class that, and the objective situation that we're dealing with today, that's moving them toward a necessity of consolidating fascism. And I think the real reason that that's happening is because we live in a time of transition. You know, everybody talks about the various motion that's taking place in the world, particularly around how things are changing, how technology is having an effect on every part of our lives. What we don't talk about a lot is how it's having an effect on the productive process, you know, on jobs. You know, many people talk about how the jobs of the future are going to be jobs that are around the whole digital age.
Right.
And those jobs are going to be very few and far between. And if we are moving toward a society that has a limited amount of jobs where people can be, you know, employed in a way that they could raise their families, then we got to, if that's true, if we move into it, less and less people being able to be employed, then the people who run this country has got to think about how do we control a population that is unemployed and, you know, on the verge of trying to figure out how they can exist from day to day.
Right.
And although they don't, I don't think there's a necessary motion toward fascism that people want. I think it's objective that people are thinking about control. How do we control and how do we maintain a stable country? And therefore, they're moving toward more ability to control a population that cannot be employed under these changing and transitioning conditions. And
so
therefore,
certainly
they're moving toward a consolidated fascism.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that we have to look at in terms of this whole question of employment, I think we have to remember that in the final analysis, capitalism demands, you know, a maximization of profit. They have to be able to not just what we consider make a little bit of money. They have to maximize their profit. And the fewer and fewer people that they're able to employ based on this introduction of high technology into the productive process, it means that their profit margins are going down. And therefore, they have to also figure out a way to expand those profit margins at the same time that technology is being introduced that eliminates a high level of jobs, and not just minimal jobs anymore, but jobs that pay well are in the process of being eliminated as well.
Yeah, I know on this segment we've discussed, for example, the private prison industry. We've talked about that in particular as not only a mode of control, but a mode of control that is increasingly privatized and that corporations are in charge of. And I guess, and I'm sure you know that many of the rules that Obama tried to change in terms of, well, really just one rule in terms of eliminating the federal prisons from the private industry, a lot of those rules are being reversed by Trump so that this industry that actually supported him in the election is now, you know, getting more bodies to fill its jails. And that would include these immigration facilities that many of the people being picked up by ICE are being funneled into. So, but in addition to that, you know, we have Rex Tillerson, former CEO of Exxon, you know, now Secretary of State, and a real kind of elimination or decrease in the capacity for the State Department to act in a diplomatic way as opposed to the military taking action. Also at Howard, you question, like, what is happening, you know, in capitalism so that this country needs a strong man personality like Trump and a personality that takes such strong man actions, like, you know, dropping the mother of all bombs and ratcheting up the war on drugs again. So can you expound on more about what you meant by that?
Yeah. But first, I want to talk a little bit about a topic you brought up just now of privatization of prisons,
mm-hmm.
because I think it's a very important issue, this whole concept of privatization. You know, I mentioned before that capitalism has to maximize profits, and they have to continuously expand their markets to figure out ways to have more and more things that they can exploit, more and more areas of the world and areas of the country. And one of the ways that they're trying to do that now is through privatization. You know, and that privatization is not ending with prisons. That's only one aspect of it. You look at, you know, over the last 20, 30 years, you know, this whole motion around welfare reform that we had in the 90s was a form of privatization where these big corporations are taking over aspects of welfare. You look at public schools, you know, the attack on public education and the creation of more and more schemes around privatization of public education, or even just the public square, you know, more and more places being taken away and trying to be put into the realm of how to make a profit off of the way that that thing functions. And so privatization is a very important economic element of this move toward the consolidation of fascism that we should really not allow to go unscathed. We need to look at that and analyze it and make sure the public is thoroughly aware of how this whole concept of privatization goes hand in hand with this development of consolidated fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on this other question, you know, it seems to me that if we're going to analyze exactly what's happening today and try to understand what that means about what's happening with capitalism that makes a strong man necessary, I think it goes back to this question of how are we going to ensure that we can maintain control and try to stabilize capitalism in this moment of transition. You know, I keep using that word transition because, you know, we're going from what has historically been an industrialized society where industry, the production of goods and services through the industrial process, has been the basis of the economic life of this society. And we're now transitioning to a digital society where, you know, this mode of production is being changed. And that's important because whenever you make a critical change like that, and a change that affects every aspect of society, you're going to create in that transition a lot of turmoil and a lot of chaos. And we can see it. I mean, what institution can we point to in this country today that's not in some form of struggle or chaos? I think, you know, if we look at what's unfolding around the Trump administration and, you know, being under this investigation after only 4 months of being in office, you know, I think that's a real indication of the kind of turmoil that the institutions of this country is in. And one of it has to do with the way the Trump administration is going about its work. But the other has to do with the fact that the country is in transition. And when you in transition and then you place unstable administration in charge, you're going to get the kind of response that we've gotten today to the Trump administration. But I think this point of needing a strong man, I think there's a certain amount of elements in this country that thought that if we could just get a good, solid, strong man, a businessman that is unorthodox and can do things the way they should be done, we can kind of fight our way through this transition.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, we're a little sorry about what we asked for at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I know that one of the things that the League of Revolutionary Black Workers did was to look at things also internationally and look at the links between workers here in this country and around the world. And also, when I think about our topic today, I'm thinking about the whole immigration crisis, not only in this country, but in Europe, around the world, where you see people in formerly colonized situations, neo-colonial situations, where Europe and United States have continued to exploit people and resources, flocking from those situations of extreme oppression and violence to the U.S., to Europe. And I want to try and work in some of our clips we have from Malcolm X for his birthday. And I want to play a piece from a speech that he made a week before he was assassinated. And in this piece, he's talking about the movement of that during that time period in 1965 of people from the developing world to the U.S. and Europe.
The governments in these different places were frightened because they know that the black revolution is taking place on the outside of their house. And I might point out right here that you have colonialism or imperialism, as the slave system of the West is called, is not something that's just confined to England or France or the United States. But the interests in this country are in cahoots with the interests in France and the interests in Britain. And by this, it's one huge complex or combine. And it creates what's known as not the American power structure or the French power structure, but it's an international power structure. And this international power structure is used to suppress the masses of dark-skinned people all over the world and exploit them of their natural resources. So that the era in which you and I have been living during the past 10 years, most specifically, has witnessed the upsurge on the part of the black man in Africa against the power structure. He wants his freedom. And now, mind you, the power structure is international. And as such, its own domestic base is in London, in Paris, in Washington, D.C., and so forth. And the outside or external phase of the revolution, which is manifest in the attitude and action of the Africans today, is troublesome enough. The revolution on the outside of the house or the outside of the structure is troublesome enough. But now the powers that be are beginning to see that this struggle on the outside by the black man is infecting the black man who is on the inside of that structure. I hope you understand what I'm trying to say. The newly awakened people all over the world pose a problem for what's known as Western interests, which is imperialism, colonialism, racism, and all these other negative isms or vulturistic isms. And just as the external forces pose a grave threat, they can now see that the internal forces pose an even greater threat.
Yeah, so I wanted to play a little bit of that speech and get you to respond. You know, he goes on to talk about people from formerly colonized places in the Caribbean going to France, you know, the French colonies going to Paris, the people from English colonies going to London. And when I listened to it, I thought about today, and I thought about how that movement is still happening. You know, we have like today's Middle Passage from Africa across the Mediterranean into Europe because of the horrible conditions created by colonialism, neocolonialism, and most recently the invasion of Libya and the destruction of Libya, which is metastasized, you know, in terms of the continent. So I wanted to kind of work that into our conversation.
Well, listening to that really should remind people that in many cases, the more things change, the more they remain the same. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is in 65, we were dealing with a certain level of internationalism, of a global economy that was internationalized. you think about that, you know, the way imperialism and colonialism and all that internationalized the entire struggle, and you bring that fast forward to today in this globalized world, and you begin to see some of the differences that we have to deal with. You know, in 1965, U.S. capitalism was still expanding economically, you know, and it could still afford to bribe certain sections of its own population. It could still afford, you know, to make certain kinds of concessions to workers in terms of our wages and all that. And today we're looking at a U.S. economy that is contracting. You know, we haven't had a real wage increase in this country since the 1970s. And just coincidentally, it was the 1970s in which this high technology began to be introduced into the productive process that really disrupted the relationship of labor and capital. You know, but that's another discussion.
Okay, and let me stop you there on the other discussion. Stay with us.
I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door. I'll tell them myself. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll tell them myself. Do you hear me? I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll tell them myself. I don't give me integration, give me true communication. I don't give me sorrow, I want equal opportunity to live tomorrow. Give me schools and give me better books, I can read about myself and gain my truer looks. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll tell them myself. Do you hear me now, now? I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll tell them myself. Some of us try as hard as we can. We don't want no sympathy, we just wanna be a man. To give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get them myself. Do you hear me? I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I'll get them myself. We got talents we can use on our side of town. Let's get our heads together and build it up from the ground. When some of us make money, we forget about our people.
This is Esther Verum. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. And we are in conversation with Jerome Scott, veteran activist, labor organizer, and a part of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which organized in Detroit in the late 1960s and 70s. So, Jerome, related to Trumpism and talking about workers, a lot of people feel that Trumpism is making white supremacy more entrenched. And despite his victory, do you see more whites understanding the role of race in dividing and conquering?
You know, there is, I think, an important thing that we have to really, really think about. And that is, like right now, this whole question of Trumpism. Fascism is not an individual, you know, and fascism was moving toward consolidation, and it was going to continue to move in that way, whether we elected Hillary or Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the pace would have been different. You know, electing Trump has sped the pace up toward that consolidation. Electing Hillary would have kept moving slowly in that direction, but they both have to deal with the same world, you know, and that world where this gap between wealth and poverty is expanding rapidly and causing people to realize that the American dream is becoming an American nightmare is the problem that either party, both representing the ruling circles of this country, would have had to deal with. And so we're talking about speed. We're not talking about direction. I think that's very, very important. And you know, we can get rid of Trump and still be moving in the same direction. So we got to be very clear that if we're going to mobilize against fascism, we got to begin to, you know, think about how do we go from the defensive to the offensive.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that because that's one of the things that you said. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I wanted to ask you about that because that's one of the things you said at Howard that was so intriguing. You said about going on the offensive, and I wanted to ask you, you know, how can people go on the offensive? I mean, the labor movement is really struggling, and you know, people see themselves subjected to more and more levels of oppression. How do you see activists and organizers being able to go on the offensive? And I think you also said, and hit capitalism where it hurts, you know, while we're still living underneath it.
The most important thing, I think, is that we have to begin to talk about and organize around what our vision of the future is. You know, mm-hmm. When you're on the defensive, you're defending what exists, mm-hmm. you know, and you're trying to make what exists better. In order to go on the offensive, we have got to begin to talk about, well, we have begun to talk about it, but we have got to make it a constant conversation about what our vision of the future is. What kind of society are we building? We spend a lot of time fighting against capitalism and very little time thinking about and trying to understand what we're fighting for so that we can make sure we have a strategy that will achieve what we're fighting for. That's the major ingredient of going on the offensive, is to have a vision that we can create a strategy around, that no matter how else we're trying to defend what we have, we're on the path to moving toward a vision that will, you know, secure the future for our poor people, you know, for the workers of this country, for the people that have built this country and the people that are going to continue to build this country. That is the most important ingredient in going from the defensive to the offensive.
So, Jerome Scott, you know, you have this tremendous media project that you've developed and to tell your stories about the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And I want to know, like, what are some of the important lessons, you know, from that experience and work in Detroit and Michigan in the 1960s and 70s is, you know, kind of relevant to today that you would like to apply to today in the struggles today?
Right. So a couple of things. First, since we're running out of time, let me talk a little bit about the media project. It's a project that former members of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers ourselves have put together. We interviewed about almost 50 people who were members of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and talked about all the various topics that we thought were critical. And you can look at those tapes and listen to those tapes on the website, revolutionaryblackworkers.org. That's revolutionaryblackworkers.org. Go check out some of those videos. And one of them is around what are some of the lessons that we learned that we think is really critical for you know, what we're living through today. One of the first lessons that it took us a while to learn, but we learned it and we think it's important, is that we have to constantly struggle to understand the world as it is today. We have to do political education for everybody, you know, people who are members of our organization, people who just are friends of our organization but want to know what's going on in the world. We have to take it upon ourselves to do serious analytical study so that we understand what it means for fascism to be going toward consolidation. What is that going to mean for our communities, and how do we resist it, and how do we move from resistance to revolution? The second thing lesson that we learned, I think, is that we have to constantly figure out exactly what the formulas of organizing is. We started as the League of Revolutionary Black Workers thinking that just concentrating on black workers was all we had to do. What we learned was that this very nature of capitalist society being a class society, that we not only had to take into account the role that race has played in our history, but we also had to take into account the role of class, you know, and to try to figure out what our interests across class lines are and whether or not there are points along those interest lines that coincide with our interests as race, you know, as black folks going forward. And I think, and that lesson, it took us a long time to learn, but that's an important lesson that we don't want to have to relearn. We have to organize as if we understand the nature of capitalism being a class society and capitalism being a white supremacist society. Mm-hmm. Those are the two most important lessons that I think we have to bring forth to our organizing efforts today.
Okay. Well, I've been in conversation with Jerome Scott, veteran labor organizer and founding member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which organized in Detroit and Michigan in the 1960s and 70s. He spoke at Howard University earlier this year on the topic race, class, and struggle then and now, lessons from the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Thank you, Jerome, for joining me today.
Oh, I appreciated it.
That will do it for today's show. So I want to thank Chantel James, Michelle Roberts, Lydia Curtis, Michael Byfield, and our engineer, Michael Red Eagle Nasella. We love to hear from you. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows and volunteer to work on the show. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Pacifica Radio. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. There's a green picket sign that says On the Ground. I'll be giving a talk tonight at a free reception at the Den inside the Anacostia Arts Center, 1231 Good Hope Road in Southeast DC, 6 to 9 p.m. Hope to see you there. I'm Esther Evangelista. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
to say another thing? I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time. I'll give it right back to you. Oh, what is this doing?